Tonight, death by dealer. New York cops are reportedly searching for the person who provided actor Michael K. Williams with the drugs found in his upscale Brooklyn apartment when they showed up Monday to investigate his death. A friend of Williams joins me with some heartbreaking video of the actor warning kids not to make the same mistakes that he did. So should drug dealers be charged with murder if their customers die? Meet a New York lawmaker who wants that law made. And then, yet another bizarre twist in the Murdoch family tragedy in South Carolina's Lowcountry as brother turns on brother amidst a string of shootings and murders. Welcome to Banfield, the war on drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Just say no to drugs. Remember all those slogans? Most of the anti-drug programs of the 80s and 90s targeted the people who were using the drugs, the buyers, the addicts. But have we been getting it wrong all these years? Should we have been way tougher on the people supplying the poison? It is a question that is right now top of mind after beloved award-winning actor Michael K. Williams was found dead in his expensive New York apartment, reportedly with drug paraphernalia nearby. If it is confirmed that he overdosed, should his dealer go down for murder? Lawmakers across the country are throwing a virtual murder book at the source of the drugs, the dealers. New laws are popping up all across the country, bringing the hammer down on those who illegally sell drugs that end up killing the user. Under these new death by distribution or death by dealer laws, drug dealers can be charged with murder if someone overdoses on drugs that they've sold. The prosecutors won't even need to prove that the dealer meant to kill the customer. It is a controversial idea, but not an isolated one. I want you to take a look at this map of the United States of America. 25 states now have some form of death by dealer law. It's a sign of just how bad the drug crisis in this country has become. Most of us know somebody who's battling a drug addiction or has died from it. And even if we don't, we certainly have heard of a celebrity who has. Let's just go down the list for a moment. In 2014, Philip Seymour Hoffman died of a heroin overdose in New York. His drug dealer was arrested, but agreed to a plea deal, which got him just 25 days of community service and 5 years of probation and no jail time. In 2018, the rapper Mac Miller died of an accidental overdose of fentanyl, alcohol, and cocaine. Three men have been arrested and charged and will stand trial later this year, but there is no death by dealer law in California. Also in that state, next month, the staffer who allegedly gave Los Angeles Angels pitcher Tyler Skaggs a fatal dose of fentanyl will stand trial. But again, no death by dealer law there. And now Michael K. Williams, who won rave reviews for his performance on Omar on The Wire. He died just 2 days ago. An official cause of death not yet released, but multiple media outlets, including TMZ, are reporting police found drug paraphernalia in his home, and police are now searching for his drug dealer as part of a criminal investigation. I'm joined by one of Michael K. Williams' close friends, Richard Thomas. He's the former mayor of Mount Vernon, New York. Michael teamed up with him to speak to at-risk youth about addiction, and you're about to see some exclusive video of that talk that Michael gave to those kids. I'm also joined by New York State Senator Todd Kominski, who proposed a law that would see drug dealers charged with murder if their customer dies. Welcome to both of you. Richard, I want to begin with you, if I can. Have you heard anything else or anything new regarding the death of your friend Michael and whether, in fact, they know if or if it was not, in fact, an overdose?
At this time, there's no information really available about the cause of death, but what is a fact is that the community, Brooklyn, New York, is all broken up over the loss of Michael so suddenly and so tragically.
Yeah, I mean, this has really hit a nerve for a lot of people. Perhaps it's the fact that he was, you know, a big star in a lot of favorite shows. Perhaps that he's up for an Emmy, I think, next month. And so just the loss is just so profound when someone you feel like you know, or at least you're familiar with, is no longer with us. I want to play, if I can, Richard, one of the videos that you have so generously and graciously allowed us to show our viewers. And it's a video of you teaming up with Michael K. Williams as he gives a very impassioned, a very from the hip, authentic speech about the life that he's led and the choices that he's made, beseeching these kids not to make the same choices. Have a look.
My 22nd birthday, I was in a drug rehab trying to get my head together, right? Came home, and by 25, I got cut in my face and my neck all over. This happened. You see, I don't know if you can see, but I have scars on my face. This is not makeup. This ain't the light shining. This is the scar that goes down the middle of my face, and the other one wraps around my neck and stops at my jugular. This was on my 24th birthday. Okay? So I made a few bad choices myself. I've been in institutions. I've been in trouble. Right? I made some bad choices, but I got a second chance in life. You know, thanks be to God. And I am a praying man, so just put that out there. You know, I do believe in God, and God gave me a second chance in life. And so, for me, I made a promise. If I was given a second chance in life, I would make sure that I tell my story, tell where I've been, tell what I've learned, so that you guys don't make the same dumb decisions that I made.
Richard, it's heartbreaking to see you standing there with him giving that message. And he seems just so positive, like everything is just so together. If this, in fact, turns out to be an overdose, do you think that the person who supplied him with the killer drugs should go down for murder?
Absolutely. I mean, there has to be some kind of responsibility on the people that are, you know, providing these illegal substances to people in our community. And that's what Michael represented most. He wanted to bring the community together. And everyone recognized the work of this powerful advocate in trying to not just reform criminal justice, but also, you know, help young people, our future, make better decisions. So this is just a sad turn of events. And it goes to show you the dark side of decadence. And it goes to show you that addiction is a real disease that we need to treat differently.
Senator Kaminsky, you know, Michael K. Williams was a New Yorker. He's one of your constituents. And there you are behind this bill, pushing this idea that it should actually bring a sentence that is commensurate with those who take lives, killers, murderers, those who are convicted of manslaughter. What are the odds? What are the chances that your bill, death by dealer, is going to pass?
You know, first of all, Richard, extremely sorry for your loss. I know, you know, we all shared in a little bit of your friend, but he was your friend in particular, and just very, very sad outcome. But it's not celebrities only. All of us in our communities have really felt the devastation of the opioid epidemic. And these last year with COVID, we've really taken a step backward. And fentanyl is really changing the game. It's poison. People should assume that any drugs they're buying has fentanyl in it, and just a small amount can kill you. You're really playing Russian roulette by taking any illicit drug like heroin or cocaine. And if it has it in it, it could be too late before you even recognize it. Drug dealers who specifically put fentanyl in their products to hook people and to save money on doing so, to me, it's the same thing as walking up and pulling out a gun and pulling the trigger on somebody. And the law has to treat it as such. I am a former prosecutor. I firmly believe that there is a role for mental health treatment in our system, for substance abuse treatment, for prevention. All of that matters. But we can't have a world where someone knowingly laces drugs with poison and are out on the street dealing to other people shortly thereafter. We can't have a system like that. And my law would obviously aim at treating dealers who deal drugs that kill people much more seriously, but the highest level would be reserved for those who really go out of their way to do crazy things like put fentanyl on their drugs, target people just coming out of rehab, target children. And the law should have those gradations built in for a real deterrence effect.
Yeah, children especially. But man, let me tell you, this problem just crosses every single socioeconomic, grade within our society. It just doesn't pick between the rich, poor, pink, black, white, brown, blue. It's just everywhere. Richard, I wanted to just ask you, not only as a friend of Michael K. Williams, but also as the former mayor of Mount Vernon in New York, there was already a trend towards this opioid crisis and people losing their lives and fentanyl becoming part of our vernacular. But now with COVID, we're learning that fentanyl is just kind of easier, cheaper, more readily available, and that the dealers are struggling with the supply chain too. So they've turned to lacing the coke and lacing the other drugs with fentanyl. And we've just seen the results of that. 6 deaths in the North Fork of Long Island from cocaine that was laced from fentanyl. 3 comedians affected. A couple of them died out in Los Angeles from cocaine that was laced with fentanyl. I'm assuming that you saw this trend and you're continuing to see this trend in the work that you do with the community.
Yes, there's an element of incentive, and we have to remove the incentive for not just selling and distributing the drugs, but we also have to compete with people that are trying to get our children and our family members hooked on drugs. And I know the devastating effects of it, you know, firsthand from being married, but also having siblings who have struggled with the addiction. I can tell you that, you know, knowing that Michael was struggling, but reaching out and still, you know, doing the work of trying to convince young people to make a different decision, make a better decision than he made of his own, is just another testament to how important of a role he played to build bridges so that the next generation can make these choices when they're confronted with them. And the key thing is, when it comes to the illegal drugs that are laced with fentanyl, this is where we have to go back to the basics. You have to go back to sports, baseball, football, track, field, and try and teach our young people the values of life, not just the price of life. And unfortunately, it took something horrible to happen to start waking people up to what the senator is talking about making some changes so we make better choices going
forward. Sometimes it is that, you know, the Heath Ledgers of the world, the Philip Seymour Hoffmans, that just bring it right to the forefront of the headlines. Again, everyone feels like they know these people, so it's personal. Senator Kaminsky, I do want to ask you, because, you know, on its surface, I can't imagine anyone who's watching right now who doesn't think, yeah, why isn't it already, you know, that kind of a felony level offense? Why isn't it a manslaughter, a murder? How couldn't it have been? Why have we left it this long? What's the downside? And then you hear about the other pratfalls, like, well, it might actually stop people from calling 911 when someone's overdosing, thereby leading to more deaths. And that's got to be accommodated in all of this, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's no doubt that there are safe harbor provisions that can help those who call 911, and they shouldn't fear doing so. We want to arm people with certain over-the-counter drugs that will allow you to revive someone who has an overdose. But at the end of the day, the worst conversation someone could have is with a parent who had a child die of an overdose, who actually sees the same drug dealer that dealt the drugs to her son or daughter standing on the corner dealing to other people. Society can't work if that's what we're having, and that currently is happening all over the place in my state that doesn't have this law. I think that we can make a distinction between those who need help and need the system to treat them a certain way, and those who are just downright callous, target the vulnerable, put fentanyl in their drugs, knowing that it could likely kill someone. We have to treat those individuals differently, and the law must treat that seriously. Right now in New York, it doesn't. That's what my law is trying to change.
Well, I'm fascinated to follow this, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us about it, Senator Kaminsky. Thank you. And Richard Thomas, my heart goes out to you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing that really lovely moment of Michael K. Smith with us and with the viewers. We appreciate it, and my condolences to you.
Thank you.
Still to come, you know, it is one thing to have these laws, but then it's quite another to enforce them. So I'm going to ask a police officer, a former prosecutor, and the judge if it's going to work, if it would work in their cities, and if they'd support it. You'll be fascinated to hear some of the things they say next. Welcome back to Death by Dealer, our special coverage of the new law enforcement tactic of charging drug dealers with murder if their product kills someone. So far, 25 states have laws on the books that hold drug dealers criminally liable for a person's death. But having a law and enforcing a law are two very different things. Should drug dealers be charged with murder? Is law enforcement a good treatment for addiction? I'm joined by three people who know a lot about law enforcement. Judge Alex Ferrer is a former 11th Circuit Court judge from Florida and the former host of the show Judge Alex. Mary Fulginiti is a former federal prosecutor from Los Angeles. And Chief Jim Smith is the chief of police in Monessen, Pennsylvania, and a co-chair of the Mon Valley Opioid Coalition. All right, so Chief Smith, I'd like to start with you just with this notion that it sounds very popular, on the surface. If a drug dealer supplies the drugs that kill the user, it just sounds natural that they should have some level of manslaughter or murder. But it's not always that easy, is it?
No, knowing that someone committed a crime and proving that they committed that crime are two totally different things in the courtroom. And unfortunately, when you're dealing with a drug delivery resulting in death case like the charge we have here in the state of Pennsylvania, your best witness is deceased. It needs to be more than just death. It needs to be drug delivery that results in serious bodily injury, such as an overdose where the person is brought back with naloxone or Narcan so that person can go to court and testify against their drug dealer. That's one thing that they have on a federal level that works. If we have that on the state level, that would be beneficial.
I think about it all the time. And Mary Fulginiti, maybe you can help me work through this. You know, a jury in a criminal trial has a beyond reasonable doubt, not beyond all doubt. Right. So if you have evidence like they do in the North Fork of Long Island, that there are all these text messages between the now dead user and the person who delivered the drugs, meaning, 10 minutes ago, I'll let you up, bring me this amount of X. It seems like a jury would say, well, that sounds pretty obvious. What more could you possibly need? Why does that not always fly?
Well, yeah, it's unfortunately not that black and white. I mean, look, I definitely agree that we need to hold these dealers responsible and the punishment needs to be proportionate to deter the behavior. But when you're looking at murder one and murder two, right, you've got different elements, and those elements require premeditation, intent, deliberation, et cetera, not for murder two, but for murder one. And those are very difficult to prove unless you're able to find some text messages that say, well, we have a lethal amount of fentanyl in the drugs we just distributed to A, and A is now dead. And oh my God, we knew that. I mean, so that's a challenge, I think, that many of the states are having, charging these dealers and these guys with murder charges. I think that's why you're seeing so many death by dealer laws being drafted to accommodate really what's been happening here. I mean, it's hard under traditional murder laws to go after these guys. I mean, especially in a traditional overdose case where somebody just takes too much of one drug and dies. But it's a different story now with fentanyl. Fentanyl is like lacing a drug with poison that will kill and is intended to kill in the amounts and the doses that it's been laced with. So I think that is the game changer, and I think that's what's ultimately leading the charge, because this is not a new issue. I mean, Heath Ledger, that was a long time ago. Anna Nicole Smith, we had many people dying of drug overdoses, because dealers or even the doctors were just prescribing a never-ending litany of drugs. So hopefully this will be the beginning.
I mean, I was going over all the dates. Anna Nicole Smith was 2007. Philip Seymour Hoffman was 2014. They kind of feel like yesterday, but you're right. I remember having the same conversations back then. Alex Ferrer, it's frustrating for the average person out there who's not, who doesn't have more degrees than a circle like you guys do. But it just feels wrong when the getaway driver at a bank robbery where someone shot inside can be up for the death penalty, right? As a felon, right? But in this circumstance where you actually provide a drug that kills someone, And there is an evidence trail, meaning you delivered something that was laced with fentanyl. There's no other drugs found in the apartment. The dead person has fentanyl in his system, a lethal amount. It just seems to stand as reason that that should be the same, if not worse, Alex, than the getaway driver.
No, I totally agree with you. I have no problem with these death by dealer laws. As you pointed out, that concept has already existed in the law for a long time. The getaway driver of an intended bank robbery ends up getting charged with felony murder. He never intended to murder anybody. But under the felony murder statutes, if you intended to commit that crime, which is enumerated in the statute, and somebody dies as a result, you're guilty of murder. The legislature could do it in multiple ways. They could just increase the penalty for sale of heroin or sale of any product that contains fentanyl to 100 years. I mean, Louisiana did that. So there are multiple ways to go after the dealers, and they should. I mean, you mentioned some celebrities who died. I remember Prince. Prince overdosed on fentanyl. People don't recognize or don't realize how small of an amount of fentanyl is deadly. 2 milligrams. 2 milligrams is how much a small mosquito weighs. That's enough to kill a person.
We got a picture of it, Alex. You know what? Since you're mentioning it, let me ask the control room to grab that picture of the penny. We've got a penny that compares to that little tiny amount of white powder on the side. That's the lethal dose of fentanyl, according to the DEA. So I'll tell you what, Jim Smith, jump in here and tell me a little bit about the illegal drug dealers who we're talking about, and then all those drug companies and doctors who prescribe opioids that kill people as well. If you have this death by dealer law, do you ever worry as a police officer that that actually could extend to drug companies too?
Yes, it could. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning and decides, hey, I'm going to become an addict and, I'm going to get addicted to a drug that's so potent that 2 milligrams of it can kill the average human being. A lot of addicts are addicts because they were prescribed prescription drugs. Then when doctors cut them off of those prescriptions, they had to turn to the street drugs. They're heroin. Hard to get a hold of. However, fentanyl, quite easy to get a hold of with the mega labs down in Mexico, and how the fentanyl is transported into the United States. You know, a lot of the same routes that cocaine was brought into the United States in the 80s. You also have people with pill presses that are pressing fentanyl into fake Xanax bars, into fake other prescribed pain pills, and people are selling them on the street as pain pills, and they're not. They're a binder that's combined with fentanyl, and nobody's regulating. You know, it's not like the FDA is regulating how these street pharmacists, you know, make their pills or make their bags or put the fentanyl to cut their cocaine. Nobody's regulating that. It's absolutely. I mean, 2020, we had 93,000 people die of overdoses in the United States. And in 2021, we're going to peak at over 100,000 deaths due to overdoses.
I mentioned that the supply chain has been affected, and that's why the dealers are turning to fentanyl. It's also upped the demand because a lot of people during pandemic started to demand a lot more drugs. We're not going to solve it now, but I sure am appreciative of all three of you. Chief Jim Smith, thank you. Mary Fulginiti and Judge Alex Ferrer, thank you always. It's good to see you. Mary, I'm going to ask if you can stick around, though, because after the break, there's some brand new clues that have just dropped in that low country mystery in South Carolina. But clues to what? Very strange, as you see investigators out there trying to find any piece of information. A hole in a tire, a shot to the head, now reports of a knife that could answer one question but raise 100 more in the Murdoch murder saga. Welcome back. The man at the center of the Murdoch murder saga is out of a job as of last Friday, recovering from a superficial gunshot wound to the head sustained on Saturday, in rehab for drug addiction as of Monday. and as of today, suspended from the bar in South Carolina. For decades, Alex Murdoch practically embodied the Low Country legal establishment, and that didn't change when his wife and son were found murdered on the family's hunting grounds a few months ago in June. It did change, however, and fast, over Labor Day weekend, when he claimed that he was shot in the head while changing a tire on his late wife's luxury SUV. Purportedly, the tire had been slashed and was flat. And today, a local news service that's covered the Murdochs extensively said the police have recovered the knife used to slash it and then connected that knife to Murdoch himself. It's a lot, I know. Also today, Murdoch's older brother and former law partner, Randy, issued this statement, and hold on to your hat. Quote, I was shocked, just as the rest of my PMPED, that's the law firm, family, to learn of my brother Alex's drug addiction and stealing of money. I love my law firm family and also love Alex as my brother. While I will support him in his recovery, I do not support, condone, or excuse his conduct in stealing by manipulating his most trusted relationships. Notice, no alleged, and that's a lawyer. And that brings me to the alleged embezzlement that cost Alex Murdoch his place at the family business, and at least for now, has cost him his profession. All while the mystery, the bizarre mystery of the mother and son murders remains unsolved, with no one, including Alex, officially ruled in or ruled out as a suspect. I'm joined now by News Nation correspondent Janelle Fort. You were just in the Low Country. What are people saying about these developments that just seem to cascade daily?
Well, Ashley, you know, there's been questions from the start. We've been covering this story since Paul and Maggie were murdered back in June, and this is a close-knit community. Again, the Murdoch family has dominated the legal sphere in that community for generations, right? So it's one of those things that even as a reporter, when we go out and we do what we call man on the street interviews, right, trying to get just people in the community to comment on what's going on, everyone is very tight-lipped about this. There's this reigning power from this family that's kind of keeping people from wanting to speak out, wanting to say anything against them, even in light of all this craziness. This is one of those stories that each time you scratch your head, each time you look at this mystery and you think it can't get any crazier,
right?
Then there's another twist, right?
It just does, yes. Janelle Fort, thank you for that. I do appreciate it. Keep us posted on what you find out on this one. I'm joined again now by former federal prosecutor Mary Fulginiti and also by retired NYPD lieutenant and Pace University professor Darren Porcher. Okay, Dr. Porcher, first to you. This sounds awfully strange. Apparently, a few days ago, a man who was looking at a flat tire that had apparently been knifed sees a truck go by, sees the truck turn back around and approach him and, according to his lawyer, ask if he needs help and then shoots him. But we, the public, don't get a description of a truck or a description of a shooter. Does this sound weird to you?
It sounds very weird, to say the least. One of the things that law enforcement is going to do is they're going to conduct an assessment of the knife. Now, there's going to be a serrated edge to the knife. If that knife punctured that tire, then you'll have fragments of that rubber on that knife. That's going to be telling, in addition to if there's a DNA sample from the individual's hand on that knife. That's where you have the connection there. It's just very strange that we have no description. We don't really have any information in terms of who's driving this vehicle. In addition to that, we've got to look to see what is the trajectory of the bullet, because my understanding, a bullet was fired here. That'll tell us whether he was either standing, if he was sitting, or what position he was in. Could this be an attempted suicide?
Multiple.
These are germane
multiple
components.
Bullets, apparently.
Right.
There were lots of shell casings, apparently, at that scene. Let me throw one more bit of, you know, twist into this, Mary. The Duffy Stone, it's a great name. It's almost like a made-for-TV movie. He recused himself. He was sort of like the DA. It's a different term down there, but he was like the DA, and he recused himself back on August 11th, but the information's only just now becoming public, that he stepped away from the case. He didn't step away for a long time, even though he's got all these ties to the law firm and to the Murdochs. But he said it's because new information posed a conflict of interest. All of that, as still there's no description of a truck, no description of a shooter, nobody's been charged, no one's ruled in or out, nobody's found anybody responsible for the murders of Paul and Maggie, and then there's the weirdness of the knife, which doesn't really tell us much. Even if it is Alex's knife, it doesn't mean that he stabbed his tire.
You're right. I mean, first, with regard to the recusal, I found that to be a little odd that he's recusing himself now, given the fact that he did recuse himself from the son's case. And that he's been charged with that fatal boat crash involving the death of that young 19-year-old girl. So that to me is a little, because if he's close to the family, which obviously he's the first solicitor, which is like the DA in that county, to take over since the grandfather, and then the great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather. So I'm a little surprised, and obviously I don't think that bodes well for Alex, because it seems like there must be some information that he feels uncomfortable with and uncomfortable staying on the case as an impartial person to be able to hear it.
So it's, you guys ready for this? As we're having this conversation, I'm sorry, Mary, I just have to tell you, I just got this little piece of news that apparently the Murdoch family murders are going to be explored in a doc series that's in the works at HBO Max. So I wasn't wrong when I thought it was a made-for-TV movie. This actually just broke. So, okay, Darren, the law license of Alex was suspended today. I guess it's not unusual that if you're being investigated for embezzling money out of your firm and your brother basically convicts you in his statement, doesn't say alleged, says my brother's stealing, that would be a natural. We shouldn't read into anything regarding these other crimes, the shootings, the murders, etc., that this guy's now lost his law license, right?
Absolutely. The cooperation of a family member in many instances is germane. So when we take in consideration the suspension of a law license in a state such as South Carolina, this information is presented to a board and they make an assessment as to if the law license should be suspended or not. And when you have close ties such as a family member, I think that sets a far better precedent than a complete stranger or someone that has an axe to grind.
It just gets weirder and weirder and more HBO-er by the day. Mary Fulgenady, thank you. Darren Porter, as always, thank you. It's good to see both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, it was 53 years ago that Bobby Kennedy was fatally shot by Sirhan Sirhan at the Ambassador Hotel in California. Today, RFK's widow, Ethel Kennedy, has spoken out against the parole decision for his assassin, but not all in her family agree with her. We're going to dip into the Kennedys and where they stand on this incredible story next. It just seems the Kennedy curse continues. Ethel Kennedy, the 93-year-old widow of Robert F. Kennedy, has spoken out about the potential release of her husband's assassin. In a tweet posted today by Carrie Kennedy, daughter of Ethel and RFK, she asks all to read her mother's words, and those words are as follows. Bobby believed we should work to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of the world. He wanted to end the war in Vietnam and bring people together to build a better, stronger country. More than anything, he wanted to be a good father and loving husband. Our family and our country suffered an unspeakable loss due to the inhumanity of one man. We believe in the gentleness that spared his life. But in taming his act of violence, he should not have the opportunity to terrorize again. The last part of the image shared seems to be written in ink, and it looks like it's written by Ethel Kennedy, saying, he should not be paroled, signed Ethel Kennedy. The California Parole Board's findings last month that Sirhan Sirhan no longer poses a threat to society after 53 years behind bars and could be eligible to be released from prison, well, that has caused a divide in the Kennedy family. Going public with their thoughts on the matter, RFK's widow Ethel, along with her grandson, U.S. Representative Joseph Kennedy, and her daughter Carrie Kennedy, They all oppose the parole decision for 77-year-old Sirhan Sirhan. But, and it's a big but, Ethel's son, RFK Jr., and Ethel's other son, Douglas Kennedy, who was just 1 year old at the time of the death of his father, they have supported the parole for their father's killer. We had the opportunity to talk to Robert F. Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy's daughter, Carrie Kennedy, about Sirhan Sirhan's potential release from prison, as well as the rift that this issue has caused in the family. Take a look. Carrie, by my math, I think you were just, 8 years old when your dad died. Thank you so much for being here. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this extraordinary development.
Yeah, you know, my all of us in our family and so many friends of my dad and all of us are shocked, horrified, scared, and just really cannot understand how this parole board would let something like this happen. You know, he thought about it in advance. He killed my father in cold blood next to my mother, who was pregnant with my little sister, Rory. And then they say, what was it? It wasn't heinous enough. It didn't rob 11 children enough of their father. It didn't rob our country enough of this great leader who sought only to heal us. And look at what's happened to our country as a result. And then they say it's okay. Let him go. I don't understand it.
So, Carrie mentioned that her siblings had a unified front to challenge Sirhan Sirhan's release. But diving a little deeper, it certainly wasn't a united front. Take a look.
I'm going to fight this with everything I've got, and so are my siblings.
How does that square with your two siblings, Robert and Douglas, who did not oppose this? I want to know about the dynamics.
I mean,
here.
Listen, Bobby believes that there's a conspiracy theory behind the vaccines. He believes that there's a conspiracy of all the pharmaceutical companies. He believes that there's a conspiracy that disappeared the flight that was lost over Asia. He believes there's a conspiracy theory about my Uncle Jack's death. I mean, just find one and he'll go out and promote it. And he's been banned from Instagram and Facebook and Twitter because of his promoting these absolute untruths again and again and again. So why in the world anyone would take him seriously is just beyond comprehension. And my brother Douglas, I haven't seen his statement, but what I understand, he talked about the importance of compassion and forgiveness and love. And, you know, we're all for compassion and forgiveness and love. But even if you have a puppy that goes into your shoe closet and chews up your shoes, you forgive it. But you don't let him back in the shoe closet.
So Carrie Kennedy, of course, as the daughter of Bobby Kennedy, also talked about the pain that she still feels even 5 decades after the events at the Ambassador Hotel.
When you lose your dad at such a young age, we were blessed because a lot of people stepped in and a lot of people worked hard to help my mom and to be there for all of us, but there's some things nobody else can do, and it really leaves the work of love undone. And I have 9 siblings, 9 surviving, so there are 9 of us now. There were 11. It's hard to imagine that our family, you know, this has caused untold pain and trauma to each and every one of my siblings, and to my dad's brothers and sisters, to his nieces and nephews, to so many people who loved him, to my mother most especially, to his mother. and then and his father, and then to my children. I have three daughters who never met their dad.
And of course, she met that they'd never met my dad, meaning her own dad. But she was obviously very emotional in that interview. And we're going to continue to keep you updated on this story and the potential release of Sirhan Sirhan. It's not over yet. It's not over yet. Still the full board. And then, of course, the governor after 53 years. Coming up next, an update on my Afghan translator, Jawad, and his family's struggle to reach America. It's been 2.5 weeks since this story came out, and I've got a great picture to show you. World's looking better already for these two. I'll tell you about the journey in a moment. Before we leave tonight, I've got some great news, an update on the family of my Afghan translator, who we're calling Jawad to protect his anonymity. While he was able to get to the U.S. As a U.S. citizen, look at him, he worked for George W. Bush, his family was targeted and they were trapped back in Afghanistan. So myself, along with some friends in the military and the press who all worked with Jawad as a translator, we formed a digital Dunkirk to get his family out. And that we did. Secret operation to rescue them from a safe house and get them to the airport and safely out of the country. And this is the Afghanistan they left behind. Feast your eyes. That's the former U.S. embassy right there in Kabul. And no, you're not mistaken. It's painted over with the Taliban flag. And the Taliban has, after all, formed an official government there. The government that includes now four very distinct members. They were former prisoners at Guantanamo Bay who were swapped for an American POW, Bo Bergdahl, in a highly controversial deal. You will remember that Bo Bergdahl went AWOL and was captured and held prisoner in Afghanistan for 5 years. And speaking of that Taliban government, they are up to their old tricks, street justice, whipping people who don't fall into line. We got video of what happened to several women in Kabul who dared to protest the current regime. They were out there with their signs, and sure enough, they got whipped. And it's, of course, for these reasons that my former translator, Jawad, couldn't have been more thrilled to see his family saved from a life under people like that. After being stuck in Qatar for 2.5 weeks, last weekend, they finally boarded a flight and came to the U.S. And here's the moment that Jawad and his daughter laid eyes on each other after their arrival outside of Dulles Airport. Here she comes, running to daddy's arms. And you certainly cannot blame Jawad for stopping the video before he could wrap his hands around that little sweetheart. The journey was a long one, as is obvious by the picture of his son. Sleepy. What a happy ending, though. Just want to let you know that the mother, sisters, brother-in-law are going to be processed at a military base, but they're here. Thanks for joining us.